Yeah. Well, good morning. It's that time of the year again for me. I get a chance to preach once a year, and Mike noticed in his calendar that year had not had passed. So here we are again now. There we go. Are those my slides, Max? Excellent. Good. So I've been following along the way different preachers preach in the East over the last year or so, and realized you have to have the slides. You know, woe to you if you arrive with no slides in pocket. Unfortunately, I must apologize, there is no video. I know. And I know a lot of people were texting me, sending me messages saying, Tony, have you got the video from the days when you did your ballroom dancing? I'm sorry, I don't. But it's true, I did used to do that, but no, I don't have any videos. That was many, many years ago. I know you won't realize that. I might say quite a lot older than I look. I got my hair cut. I take this very seriously. I got my hair cut just for today. Anyway, let's turn to Psalm 10. And it was encouraging that I think Opie used one of the Psalms in the welcome this morning. And I've been reading the Psalms over the summer. hope you've been having a good summer. We were in the Scandinavian Churches Conference a few weeks ago, which was wonderful. And then last week we were at the inaugural Norwich Church Service, as were many of you here, it turned out. So there was a good number from the East and Friends of the East with us that day, with Marvin and Shireen. And it was obviously a great time to be part of a church that's being planted, a new church, you know, new faith going out into that city of Norwich. But if you take a step back just for a second from Wanstead and where we are here today, and you look at the summer that's gone, one of the sort of feelings that I got, and that maybe you got too, was, what in the world is going on? Or what in the world is happening? Max, do you want to change slides there? And if you go back to, let's say, you know, beginning of the summer, it all started off with a certain newspaper that doesn't exist anymore. You know, and we heard about this phone hacking scandals, you know, the shock of this, you know, journalists hacking into people's phones. Well, I think we were used to your news, but now the news was the news itself. And we're thinking, oh my goodness. And then, lo and behold, the paper folds. The paper has been going for 160 years. You think, wow, what's happening? The paper folds. Go to the next one, Max. Next slide. Then, more saddening, Norway. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavia. Norway is a very peaceful, calm country. It's very safe to walk around. And then this guy, Anders Breivik, who's a political ideologist, explodes a bomb and then goes on an island and shoots 70, 80 young people. Very sad. And again, we're thinking, what in the world is going on? Let's go to the next slide. If you're one of those guys now, for the intellectual financial dudes who follows the stock market, and the thing is, we're all involved in this somehow, seeing as now the government owns two of the major banks of the UK. But over the last few weeks, thanks, Izzy, over the last few weeks, you may have noticed that the stock market has just been going down and down and down. If you follow these things, you have what they call the sovereign debt crisis. In other words, you know, if you borrow money to buy, say, a house, you're expected to pay it back. Otherwise, it's called defaulting and you lose the house. Well, what if a country does that? What if a country, say, Greece, borrows a lot of money and then decides, oh, sorry, we can't afford to pay it back? What happens there? Even worse, what if that country is the US? And that was what was happening. They were arguing until late at the night, should we change some laws and stuff so that we can carry on paying our debts? Oh, dear. What in the world is going on? And the stock markets, they're very sensitive beasts. They react to all this stuff happening, and they say, let's sell. Let's go to the next one. And then it all comes very crashing close to home. You know, these things were all at a distance. Then a couple of weeks back, there's the shooting in Tottenham, and then it all goes crazy. We have the riots in Tottenham, and then they spread to other parts of London, goes around to Birmingham, goes up to Manchester. And by now, if you hadn't had that feeling, you've got the feeling, what in the world is going on? So today's sermon is called, What in the World? Let's go to the next slide. I think it's another. Yeah, I think that's Croydon. And the next slide. So that's what I say. If you like sermons, what in the world? Let's go to the next one. So our first point, number one, is news of the world. Okay, let's turn to and read now in Psalm 10. And we're going to read verses 1 to 11. Probably would help if I found Psalm 10. Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In his arrogance, the wicked man hunts down the weak, who are caught in the schemes he devises. He boasts of the cravings of his heart. He blesses the greedy and reviles the Lord. In his pride, the wicked does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there's no room for God. His ways are always prosperous. He's haughty, and your laws are far from him. He sneers at all his enemies. He says to himself, nothing will shake me. I'll always be happy and never have trouble. His mouth is full of curses and lies and threats. Trouble and evil are under his tongue. He lies in wait near the villages. From ambush he murders the innocent, watching in secret for his victims. He lies in wait like a lion in cover. He lies in wait to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. His victims are crushed. They collapse. They fall under his strength. He says to himself, God has forgotten. He covers his face and never sees. Still a note about the Psalms. So the Psalms in the Old Testament were written over a period of several hundreds of years. So they'd have been penned by one author. But then they were used in the worship, in the way the Jews worshipped in the temple or together. So the Psalms actually went through various iterations. So when you're asking, I wonder what, you know, who was writing this and what was it like at the time? Actually, you can't really answer that question because it was written over a period of time. It may have been written around the time of David, but it may have been being used and actually changed up until the time of a few hundred years before the New Testament. So they went through various iterations. But then this psalm is written from the point of view of an observer, a bit like us. And he's looking around and he sees what's going on. And he says, what in the world is happening? And in a way, I think this really applies to what we've seen here in London in those last few weeks with the riots. And the reason I call this news of the world was because, you know, really, England became the news of the world in those last few weeks. And I thought, well, what's happening? And then I started getting emails from former colleagues and friends from around the world. First one, my old boss from Shell. Tony, I heard about these riots. We had ours in LA a few years back. How are you? Are you okay? Okay. And then next day, I look in my inbox. Another one, another colleague from Shell, this one over in Hong Kong. Tony, I heard about the riots. We don't really get riots in Hong Kong, but how are you? Are you okay? Quickly reply, yes, I'm okay. And then the next day, another one, old friend from university, this time in Singapore. Tony, don't stop doing your work with your church, helping the young people. How are you? Are you okay? And I thought, what? The whole world is looking right now at what we're doing here in the UK. But you see, now that we're in this next phase, aren't we? Now we're in the phase of the trials trial system, working through the nights to process all the people who've been caught. And then the question comes, so why? Why did they happen? What is the cause? And various causes have been suggested. Was it simply gang culture? There were criminal gangs out there sort of, you know, directing and behind everything. Yeah, okay, maybe. Was it because of the closure of youth clubs? A lot of youth clubs up in Tottenham, that area, were closed. Is it because there's just more youth on the streets? Is it the rise in university tuition fees? You see, it wasn't all the youth. It wasn't all the teenagers. We now know it's also quite a lot of older people who were part of the riots. Maybe people who were ticked off because of having to pay higher university tuition fees. Was it the police's fault? They're too aggressive. Provoking. Or was it simple unemployment? We've just seen the figures. Oh, everybody's unemployed. There's nothing to do. We can't get food. Let's go and break in and we'll steal. The high cost of living. Similarly, we've all felt it. The cost of living's rising. Is that the reason? Someone suggested it was rap music. That wasn't a very popular suggestion. That wasn't a very correct suggestion. Someone suggested rap. So there's all kinds of theories. Some suggested broken families, absent fathers. That sounds pretty reasonable. But we're here today to say, but what does the Bible say? And funnily enough, this psalm does give us some pointers, doesn't it? Because this psalm describes a society in a very similar situation. It has the wicked hunting down the weak. It has the wicked boasting of what he wants to get, the boasting of the craving of his heart, openly, arrogantly. No one questioning it. Everyone's too afraid. It talks about them blessing the greedy. It's okay to be greedy and to put yourself first. Rejecting God's and man's laws. Lying, threatening. Waiting to attack, to ambush, to murder. Catching the weak, the helpless. Doesn't that describe what we experienced? And what is the root of all this evil? Psalm 10 says in verse 4, and I think this is the key point. In his pride, the wicked does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there is no room for God. It's a very simple, basic explanation. The reason that you do evil is because there's no picture of God in your mind. No real, or maybe you've heard of God growing up. Maybe you've heard people talking about God, but it's not really real in your heart. You've pushed it away. There's no room for God. You're just full of you, yourself. Verse 11. God will never notice. He covers his face and never sees. This is a relationship with God that says God is so far away. It's old fashioned. There's no God. If there is, it doesn't really matter. Just unreal. Not part of my life. And verse 13, he won't call me to account. Well, if there is a God, I'll go. He'll be all right. It's not that bad. I mean, stealing from the rich, it's all right. They deserve it. And you can see the way it goes. What does this teach us? When you take away the spiritual authority, the self just runs loose. And that's what happens. Interestingly, Theresa May, she's our Home Secretary, she said the riots were symptomatic of a wider malaise, including worklessness, illiteracy, and drug abuse, but also stated that everybody, no matter what their background or circumstances, has the freedom to choose between right and wrong. But you see, how do you make that choice if you don't have a great living picture of God, a relationship with God? It's just too easy to make the wrong choice. So it's all very well for me to stand here and, you know, cast stones over there. Oh, yeah, they're so bad. But what about me? What about us? Because I also can push God out of my mind. I also can be so full of myself and my own desires with different temptations that God is no longer real and living in my life. And that's the same for all of us. Parents, how are we doing at really teaching authority and respect for God for our kids? Because that's where it is. That's where it starts. It starts in these small things, just really believing and teaching authority and respect. Because we are the picture of God that our kids get. And for us, do we think and act as if God never sees? And if so, why? It's not to condemn one another, but to say, well, why is it that I don't really feel that God is so real and so close and so near? Think about that. So, first point was, use the will. Good job we have it there. Let's move on to the second point, and let's move to Psalm 49. The second point, with a much more cheery title, War of the World. Okay, so Psalm 49. Hope you're not too depressed by this point. Psalm 49, we're going to read verses 1 to 6 and verse 16. Okay, so Wordsworth. Hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all who live in this world, both low and high, rich and poor alike. My mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance from my heart will give understanding. I'll turn my ear to a proverb. With a harp, I'll expound my riddle. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches? And then again, verse 16. Don't be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases. And verse 18, so while he lived, he counted himself blessed, and men praise you when you prosper. This psalm also has a question, just like the other had a question. The other psalm started off with the question, why, God, are you so distant? This time the psalmist has the question here in verse 5. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the great riches? And when he's saying fear, he doesn't mean he's fearing for his life. He's not fearing of people who boast of riches overwhelming him. Not that kind of fear. It's more of a kind of a deep anxiety or a worry or this feeling of I'm missing out. And he's looking around and saying, whoa, hold on. It seems to be going so much better for everyone else. And he's the religious guy. And there's all these other non-religious or religious or pagan guys out there. And it seems like he feels I'm missing out. You ever have that feeling? You feel like I'm missing out. Remember when I was at school? Young, you know, as a teenager? And I'm from Manchester, South Manchester, Stockport. We had boys, girls, and girls, boys' schools and girls' schools in those days. So for us, as boys, we didn't really know what girls were, to put it bluntly. So there we were, and I guess it was probably about, and then we heard, you know, that guy over there, he's got a girlfriend. What? He's got a girlfriend. A girlfriend! See, girls, they were these things that wore blue, we wore black. They wore blue, and they were on the other side of the main road. And we'd see them, yeah, see them a little bit in the morning, see them in the evening, but that was the only contact we had, far, far away. And then, heard the news, and then another one. This guy, Martin Lewis. He's got a girl. I've got a girlfriend, he's got a girlfriend. Unbelievable. And then in my heart, I'm thinking, I'm missing out. Life is passing me by. I guess I was, what, 13? Probably. And this strong feeling, oh no. I'm losing it all. I need to be over there because life is just passing by. And we can get that feeling today. And you know, especially as a Christian, we can get the feeling of, oh, I'm missing out. I've made my decision. I'm a Christian following the narrow way. Oh, but over there, it just seems so much easier. The grass is so much greener over there. Why am I coming to church on a Sunday? My friends, I could just be at home reading the paper. Had a busy week. But, you know, there's other guys or they're off out, you know, down by the Thames enjoying life. And I came to church on a Friday or a midweek. And, you know, in our heart, there's a kind of, oh, I'm missing out. And that's what this guy is expressing. And see, this is the war of the world. That is the fight that we're up against. Because it's the world that's trying to press us and push us away from God and our commitment to God. And it does it in very subtle ways. And this is one of them, by getting our attention. Oh, I missed out. I didn't get it. And you see, the scary thing is, in the psalm, they're applauded by society. These people are successful. They're doing well. These guys aren't the rioters. These are the good people in society who are doing well. And what does society do? It applauds them. And when they're prosperous, they're successful. Do you ever watch The Apprentice? We love watching The Apprentice. You know, watching, you know, the competition, the different strategies, how they're going to solve the problems. It was great to see Tom winning the last one, because Tom was really the good guy. The first time, probably the good guy has won. Oftentimes, it's not the good guy, and there's intrigues, and there's backstabbing, and it was great to see. But again, I mean, I'm not saying, and the Bible doesn't say doing well is a bad thing. You're supposed to do well. But the problem is, when it takes you away from God, and when it takes you away from your commitment to God. So the question there is, you know, why do I miss church? Because many of us do. Many of us don't come to family group or our midweek kind of Friday. And there are reasons, there are good reasons. If you're ill, you have a shift work, something like that. But then there are other reasons. And again, I want to ask you, what is it that pulls you away? And why is it so much more interesting than being at church, than your commitment? Turn to James 4. See, the world, we have a theology, a study of God, which is the Bible, the Christian God. The world has a theology too, a study of God. Let's look at it in James 4 and verse 1. Good to hear the flicking of pages. Not everybody has got their Bible on a computer, on an iPad, on an iPhone yet. Some of us have the physical copy. James 4:1. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. And when you ask, you don't receive, because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Here's the world against the Christian faith. And what is that describe? What is the theology of the world? It's three words. Me, myself, and I. That is what the God of the world is. It's you. It's me. It's putting yourself at the center and organizing your world so everything you desire and want gets met. And that is the pressure that we face. And of course we have, again, legitimate desires and needs. But Jesus, he emptied himself of all those to set a very different life. Why is it that we can now watch TV on our mobile phones? Because of pornography. Because there's such a great demand amongst men to see sexual images that forced technology to develop the ability to see pornography on a telephone. See, we get the benefit. That's great to watch TV on a phone. But the reason it is there is because of the God of the world, which is the self. It is people putting themselves first and pushing in that direction. And I know the teenagers are away at the moment, most of them. Some of them are here, like James. But they face an intense battle. Incredible battle. And we all face a battle, but I think they face the most intense battle. Because the intensity, the pressure to conform to the world is just so great. And you have got to take your hat off to the teens. And to James today for his stand on that. But for the rest of us, the pressure is not to conform and to slip into the world. And to really be a Christian in the workplace and wherever you are. I remember a couple of times when I was working at Shell, a good friend of mine, Hisham, and we had a dinner. I can't think it was a Christmas dinner or something. So we sat at the table of us, and there's kind of a lull in the conversation. And Hisham pipes up nice and loudly, "Yes, so Tony, when he was younger, was a missionary and went to Denmark to start a church." Everybody at this point went and looked at me, and I looked up. Yes, that's right. Ha ha, indeed I did. Let me just tell you about that. Again, last week I was trying to get a friend of mine to come along today. And I like to fit in, like to just, not ruffle the feathers too much, and I invite him along. And he comes wandering over to our desk, as if he was sitting, turns to another colleague and says, "So Lisa, so are you going to come to church on Sunday with Tony? You need your soul saving as well." So there, and there I am. Yes, that's right, me. I'm, yes, me, the Christian. That's right. But it's easy, it's so easy just to want to fit in and to conform and be a closet Christian, hiding there in the closet, or even better, a chameleon. The chameleon Christian changes color to suit the surroundings so it can't be seen. And that's what we can be like, kind of hiding our faith there so we fit in and we're not seen. We've got to be different. We have to fight against the world. That is the war that we're in. Let's finish off here. Let's go to... So our final point, Max. Yeah, that's really cheery. News of the world, and now end of the world. Fantastic. It is cheery, surely. Let's go back to Psalm 49. I've lost my place. You can kick your way back or turn the pages. Let's read verses 7 to 11. 7 to 11 in Psalm 49. So remember, he's looking around and he's seeing how people chase success, and they're good people and they rely on their success. But you know, he sees something else that's going on. No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. For all can see that wise men die. The foolish and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their tombs will remain their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves. See, we all know there's an end to all of this world, and there's a sense in which we all fear death. And what the psalmist noticed was, underlying this strategy, if you like, for life, was a strategy for death. And funnily enough, in the Old Testament, in Exodus 21, 30, you can look that up later. If you were a farmer and you owned a bull, and the bull killed someone else, oops, you'd murdered, essentially, you were negligent. Your bull had killed someone else, should be put to death. But you could pay a ransom. You could pay to not be put to death. So that was in the Old Testament law. And what the psalmist said, could see was, well, actually, people, they think they can do that with God as well. They think, if I'm good enough, if I'm successful enough, if there is a God, when I meet God, he'll be all right. Because I'll just show up with my success, God will look at me and go, man, you're a good fellow, or a good lady. You know, I'm impressed. Well, excellent. And they have in their mind that God is a little bit like an accountant. And he has these books, and on these got the credits and debits, and you know, the debits are the bad things, and the credits are the good things. And see, in the mind, you kind of build up, and you count very highly your good things, and then you look around and say, "Oh, I'm not as bad as him, but that was probably wasn't right." So the bad thing, and you go through life just thinking, "Well, I think I'm all right. I think the good outweighs the bad," and that must be the way. That must be the way people think. It's certainly the way I used to think. And he's saying, and the psalmist says, that is a futile strategy. Sorry, God isn't like a great accountant. I'm sorry, there is no ransom that's ever big enough to get you out of jail. There's no payment that's ever going to be enough. You can't stand before God with your list of achievements and successes and expect God to pat you on the back. Because unfortunately, and the bad thing is, we judge ourselves way too positively. And our bad deeds way outstretch the good ones. And even then, God doesn't act like that kind of accountant anyway. If anything, we're like the US that can't pay its debt. Our debt is more like the size of the US debt than it is the size of the debt you have for your mortgage, compared to God. That is the message of the Bible. But he finishes with a surprise. Let's go to verse 13. Because that leaves the psalmist in a kind of an uncomfortable position. So how can you possibly be right with God? It's just not possible. But look at verse 13. This is the fate. 15, what I'm saying. But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. He will redeem means pay back. Somehow, the psalmist looks ahead and sees that God will somehow redeem him, pay him back, get him back from the dead. And of course, for all of us, we immediately think the New Testament, Jesus. So let's turn there. Let's go to Acts 13 to finish off. Acts 13 and verse 26. Because that is an unusual concept in the Old Testament. The idea of life after death is not explored so much. But the idea that there's a way of being right with God that's not about you. And we look at, this is Paul preaching here in Syria and Antioch. and verse 26. Brothers, children of Abraham and you God-fearing Gentiles, it's to us that this message of salvation, in other words, being right with God, has been sent. The people of Jerusalem, their rulers, did not recognize Jesus. Yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. So they found no proper ground for a death sentence. They asked Pilate to have him executed. When they carried out all that was written about him, in the Old Testament, of course, they took him down from the tree and laid him on a tomb, in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead, and for many days he was seen by those who traveled with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now witnesses to our people. We tell you the good news. What God promised our fathers, he's fulfilled for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. As it's written in the second Psalm, you're my son, today I've become your father. The fact that God raised him from the dead, never to decay, is stated in these words. I'll give you the holy and sure blessings promised to David. So it is stated elsewhere, you'll not let your Holy One see decay. For when David had served God's purpose in his own generation, he fell asleep. He was buried with his fathers and his body decayed. But the one whom God raised from the dead did not see decay. Therefore, brothers, I want you to know that through Jesus the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Through him, everyone who believes is justified for everything you could not be justified from by the law of Moses. But take care that what the prophets have said doesn't happen to you. Look, you scoffers, wonder and perish, for I'm going to do something in your days that you'd never believe, even if someone told you. I mean, we know this. But the only ransom that could be paid was Jesus himself and his sin-free body that died on the cross and that Jesus raised from the dead. So the end of the world, in a way, is a decision to end our world in the world and become a Christian. And it's exciting because that's what James has decided to do later today. But for those of us who are studying the Bible or visiting, let me challenge you. Are you relying on your good deeds? Is your trust in yourself? Or have you really decided to look into the Bible to study out what it truly means to be a Christian and to be right with God? Let me just finish off with a final illustration. It's called Who Will Take the Sun? A wealthy man and his son loved to collect rare works of art. They had everything in their collection, from Picasso to Raphael. They would often sit together and admire the great works of art. When war broke out, the son went to war. He was very courageous and died in battle while rescuing another soldier. The father was notified and grieved deeply for his only son. About a month later, just before Christmas, there was a knock at the door. A young man stood at the door with a large package in his hands. He said, "Sir, you don't know me, but I'm the soldier for whom your son gave his life. He saved many lives that day and he was carrying me to safety. When a bullet struck him in the heart, he died instantly. But he often talks about you and your love for art." The young man held out a package. It was a portrait of the son, painted by the young man. The father stared in awe at the way the soldier had captured the personality of his son in the painting. The father was so drawn to the eyes that his own eyes welled up with tears. He thanked the young man and offered to pay for the picture. "Oh no, sir, I could never repay what your son did for me. It's a gift." And so the father hung the portrait over his mantle. Every time visitors came to his home, he took them to see the portrait of his son, before he showed them any of the other great works he'd collected. The man died some months later. There was to be a great auction of his paintings. Many influential people gathered there, excited over seeing the great paintings, and having an opportunity to purchase one for their collection. On the platform sat the painting of the sun. The auctioneer pounded his gavel. "We'll start the bidding with this picture of the sun. Who will bid for this picture?" There was a silence. And a voice in the back of the room shouted, "We want to see the famous paintings. Get this one." But the auctioneer persisted. "Will someone bid for the painting? Who'll start this bidding? $100, $200. Another voice shouted angrily, "We didn't come to see this painting. We came to see the Van Goghs, the Rembrandts. Get on with the real bids." But still, the auctioneer continued. "The sun. The sun. Who'll take the sun?" Finally, a voice came from the very back of the room. It was the long-time gardener of the man and his son. "I'll give $10 for the painting." Being a poor man, it was all he could afford. "Okay, $10. We have 10. Who will bid 20? Give it to him for 10, they shouted. We want to see the Masters. $10 is bid. Won't someone bid 20? The crowd now is becoming really angry. They didn't want the picture of the sun. They wanted the more worthy investments for their collections. The auctioneer pounded the gavel. Going once. Going twice. Going for, sold for $10. There's a relief, sigh of relief. A man sitting on the second row shouted, now get on with the collection. The auction. The auctioneer laid down his gavel. Sorry, the auction's over. There was a stunned silence. What about the paintings? Oh, I'm sorry. When I was called to conduct this auction, I was told of a secret stipulation in the will. I was not allowed to reveal that stipulation until this time. Only the painting of the sun would be auctioned. Whoever bought that painting would inherit the entire estate, including the paintings. The man who took the sun gets everything. God gave his son 2,000 years ago for us. Let's make sure we take the sun, because that gives us everything.
I want to thank Tony for that lesson this morning. At this time, I want to ask James Izilo to come to the front. And I saw Sandra walk past me just a few minutes ago. Oh, Sandra's there, and where's Andy as well? Let's just have Andy and Sandra come up as well. Well, as you know, James has been studying the Bible for quite some time now. In fact, actually, Paul Rowden has been studying the Bible with James. Ben Hill has been studying with James. I've done a few studies with James myself. A lot of people have been studying with him, and Andy has been studying with his son as well. And today marks the culmination of, I think, 2 years of Bible study. James has been eager to become a Christian for some time. But, you know, we've been wanting just to make sure that he's really grasped and fully understood what it really means to follow God with all his heart. And I think everyone agrees that James has reached that point where he is ready to put on Christ in baptism. I want to ask his parents just to say a few words. I've got my money on Andy crying in 30 seconds. So, but let me ask Sandra to share first.
Well, I'm really proud of my son today. I can't put into words how I feel. I'm just so proud of him making this decision to put God first in his life, because I think his life is going to be so much more fruitful following God. I can't believe that this child, this infant who just weighed 2 pounds when he was born, is now standing here and he's going to become a Christian. I just really want to thank everybody else in church, family, friends, who have been such a great support, helping him to grow, supporting us as parents, Kingdom Kids, helping him to understand the first rudiments of the Bible. Really, really grateful. It definitely takes a village to raise a child. I'm so grateful for everybody's support here. And also just thanks for Ben, Marvin, Paul Radden, and everyone who studied the Bible with him, especially my husband here, who's been an incredible father. You know, definitely been an incredible example. But thank you so much, everybody.
Where do I start? It's certainly a great moment in our household to see our son baptized. It's great for him to have his own convictions and who's got their watch. But it's certainly been a lot of, as parents will know, it's been a lot of work. But it's great having, often I feel it's, James is gifted. James is gifted and blessed. And I don't think I've taught him, he's taught me. So that's wonderful. Now for my long list of gratitudes. No, but I'd like to thank, I know the teens are watching this at the teen camp, and I'd just like to say thank you so much for Lamont and Charles and Ben and others who were there for really being a great support to James. Also ransacking my house on many times. I do forgive you all. But thank you so much, Ben. I know Paul Rowland's not here. He has invested many hours in studying the Bible with James. And it's great to be able to see at this point him just leave us as his parents. He's now going to be my brother. And last night we went out for a good old Nigerian pounded yam meal to celebrate that. Because I knew today he would turn from being a son to a brother. So thank you all. Thank you very much.
It really has been a joy to be able to study with James as well, and just to see his eagerness and his love for God's word and his desire to want to obey the scriptures and to put on Christ in baptism. He's been asking to be baptized for many, many months. And I talked to Paul Rowden on the phone this morning. I said, you know, we would have loved to have all the teens at church to be here for his baptism, but he was just too eager. And they didn't want to wait one day longer. And Paul said, I agree, he's been ready for quite some time now. And but it is great, by the power of technology, that the teens at the teen camp could also witness this moment as well. James said to me last night, he said, there's a verse I would love to have read out at my tomorrow. And I said, what verse is that, James? He said, I want Matthew chapter 7, verse 21 read out. And for those of you who are familiar with the Bible, you know what this says. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Today, James is going to be obeying God's will as he puts on Christ in baptism. Before I baptize you, James, I have two questions to ask. Number one, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and died for your sins?
Yes.
What is your good confession?
Jesus is Lord.
Because of that confession made in the presence of all these witnesses, I'm able to baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, so your sins will be forgiven, you'll receive God's Holy Spirit, and you'll be added into his church. In just a moment, James could go off and get changed, and then I'll ask, whilst he's getting changed, if the parents could go ahead and collect their children from their classes.